It's time for All Things Northwest with Northwest Missouri State University President Dr. John Jasinski. Each month, Dr. Jasinski will visit with community and educational leaders about exciting developments and collaborations happening throughout our region. Underwriting for All Things Northwest comes from Nottoway County Economic Development and Northwest Missouri Regional Council of Governments. More at facebook.com/NWMORCOG. And now, the 10th president of Northwest Missouri State University, Dr. John Jasinski.
Welcome to this month's edition of All Things Northwest, a show devoted to all the good about the people, places, events, and stories of our region. We highlight the great work and the great play, the collaboration and the developments throughout our region. And please know there is so much to celebrate regarding Northwest Missouri, Southwest Iowa, Southeast Nebraska, and Northeast Kansas. We here at Northwest Missouri State University and your public radio partners, KXCB-KRNW, trust you and your loved ones had a great March. And like you, we're now enjoying that warmer weather and that move towards the actual spring. I am pleased to welcome you to the April 2014 edition of our show. We'll provide two segments this month. Segment one features Andy Bailey, warning coordination meteorologist from the National Weather Service in Pleasant Hill. In segment two, we feature Northwest Missouri State University's professor of geography, Dr. Mark W. Corson. Dr. Corson is also the coordinator of the interdisciplinary program in emergency and disaster management. He'll discuss his role as the coordinator of the interdisciplinary program in emergency and disaster management. Thanks for joining the All Things Northwest team, and we hope you enjoy this month's edition. To begin the program, I've asked KXCB-KRNW's John Coffey to interview Andy Bailey from the National Weather Service in Pleasant Hill. Andy is the warning coordinator meteorologist.
Andy, first of all, just talk a little bit about your background. What got you interested in becoming a forecaster?
Well, I grew up on a farm in northern Iowa, and you know, as I'm sure a lot of the students know, that farming is really dependent on the weather, so weather was a huge deal to my dad and obviously the success of the farm, and we were always watching the forecast, always watching the weather. From a young age, I was fascinated with weather, and obviously I'm old enough that back in the day on the farm, we had three channels of TV, so the only weather we had was watching the local news, and so I was probably the only five-year-old that watched the news so I could watch the weather forecast as well, and just from there, always fascinated by storms. I actually got told by my high school guidance counselor not to go into meteorology because there was no jobs in it. So I majored in physics in college and quickly learned that I didn't really like that. And you know, there's always like a 100-level class. They teach you about the opportunities, you know, in your particular major. And one of the physics tours we took on campus was the meteorology department at Iowa State University, where I went to college. And I talked to one of the professors, and he said there's going to be a ton of jobs in about 3 years, which was about when I was going to be graduating. And he was right. I changed my major, and fortunately, I am where I am today in the weather service, so really fortunate.
That's one of the things that really strikes me about people that are in your profession is just the passion you have for the job.
You know, it's really kind of weird because when you come to our office and you talk to any of the people there, any of the forecasters there, we all kind of grew up just weather geeks and weather nerds, and just some of them would sit, you know, grew up in a very snowy climate, and they just sit by the window and watch it snow, you know, during some of the epic blizzards we used to have. And for me, I was fascinated by thunderstorms and severe weather, and it's really kind of a common theme amongst many of the folks who work at the National Weather Service. We just kind of have this weird attraction to the weather, and you know, fortunately for us, we get to go to work every day and deal with the weather. You know, it's kind of one of our hobbies as well.
Talk a little bit about your career after you got out of college and where it took you right off the bat there.
Sure. After I graduated school, that was back in 92, I went to work for a private meteorological firm in Madison, Wisconsin called Weather Central. And it wasn't the best work environment in the world, and there was a certain shift that I worked that I had to forecast for about half of the world's population in 20 minutes. I had to forecast for North America, South America, Europe, and Western Asia. And you just can't make a forecast that's of any kind of quality, and you know, and in that time period, and did a lot of graphics for TV and newspapers, and I was fortunate that you know, it was a kind of a good stepping stone job right out of college. After that, I got a job at the National Weather Service office in Des Moines. And my timing, you know, going into that job, I thought, boy, this is going to be a lot less stressful than my old job. I thought it was, it was a great job, great place to start. But I started 2 weeks in 1993, 2 weeks before the Des Moines water plant was flooded by the great flood of 1993. And so it was just really from one stressful situation into another at the Des Moines National Weather Service at that time, because it was really the biggest flood in Iowa history. And it was a good kind of trial by fire, baptism by fire in that job. I learned a lot on that job. And from there, I went to the National Weather Service in Rapid City, South Dakota, where I was a forecaster and then a senior forecaster. Spent 7 years there. Great place, great office. Really interesting weather in western South Dakota. Just really, really fun stuff. And then from there, I went to the National Weather Service forecast office in Las Vegas, Nevada, of all places. Had never been to Las Vegas, but thought, yeah, how different could it be, right? It was quite a bit different from Iowa and South Dakota. But I had 4 really good years there. And again, that's not a place you think about, and you think about weather or being interesting. But the forecast challenges in that office area were immense. They had one of the largest forecast areas in the country. There are more than 100 different mountain ranges in their forecast area, and that, you know, that may not sound like a big deal, but it, instead of forecasting in 2 dimensions like we do here in the plains, you're really forecasting in 3 dimensions, and that really, it complicates things a lot. And you might say, yeah, but out in the desert, nobody lives there, it's no big deal. But there's all sorts of federally owned land that land managers are doing, you know, prescribed burns on, or there's wildfires. There's always something that needed our attention in the area. And, you know, one of the unique things that we actually forecasted for Area 51, you know, so it's kind of funny. We'd issue warnings for there. We never got any information back from them. We're always giving them the warnings, but we never got any reports back. I don't know why. Then after 4 years there, I ended up back in Pleasant Hill, and it's good to be back in the Midwest, kind of with the weather I grew up loving and just a good situation to be in.
Yeah, when you look at your career path, you couldn't ask for really more varied type of weather than the places you've worked at.
Well, that's right. And, you know, especially my first real forecaster job wasn't Des Moines. It was actually Rapid City. And that was my first taste of forecasting for what we call complex terrain, obviously mountains, you know, the Black Hills. That adds a whole new challenge. And then going to Las Vegas and with an entirely different climate than I've ever experienced before, again, just real learning opportunity. But then, you know, that all those experiences really help make you a better forecaster, because you have a greater appreciation for the range of weather that's available and possible. And I don't forecast that much in my current job anymore here in Kansas City, but still have all those that experience from those locations.
Now, Noah, at those locations too, I understand that you've really received some notice for some of the things you've done at those. At Rapid City, I understand that you received an award from the Department of Commerce with their Gold Medal Award for timely weather forecast. You might talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. Fires, wildfires were a really big deal in western South Dakota and northeast Wyoming. There's, you know, we have the Black Hills there, both in Wyoming and in the South Dakota side of the line. And wildfires are extraordinarily dependent on the weather, because the weather impacts how dry the fuels are, which then impacts how receptive they are to burn. The wind really drives the fire and will control how fast and what direction the fire spreads. Well, we had a pretty, I don't even remember what year it was. It must have been about 2001 or 2002. It was a really bad fire year out there. And there was 14 or 15 wildfires going in northeast Wyoming at the time. And we knew we had several wildfire crews out there. We had a cold front moving in from Montana that was forecast to arrive about 6 p.m., so the crews were trying to get out ahead of that cold front and knock some of the stuff down. We had some thunderstorms develop in southeast Montana that ended up pushing the cold front through about 4 hours earlier than forecast. So it was kind of once we recognized that, it was a mad scramble to contact all of the wildfire crews that were on these fires. And fortunately, we were able to contact this one crew of 50 firefighters that they said, had we not contacted them and let them know that the wind was going to shift, which then would shift the fire spread, they probably would have been burnt over. And they said probably 50 firefighters would have been killed. So, you know, it's just one of those things where, I mean, it doesn't feel like I saved anybody's life or anything like that, but that's just one of the one of the nice things about working for the National Weather Service is people do make some pretty important decisions on the weather information we give them, and that was one of those instances where the forecast we gave them did help them out tremendously, obviously.
I imagine, technology is something that has changed almost every profession that's out there, but I would imagine one profession that's changed as much as any has to be your profession. And talk a little bit about how technology has changed what you do through the years.
Probably the best story I have to illustrate that. When I started out in the National Weather Service in Des Moines in 1993, one of my jobs was to take radar observations on, it was called the 57C radar. And the 57 stood for 1957 because that's when it was commissioned. So in 1993, I'm using a 1957 radar. And it was just like you see in the movies, it was a dark room and there was kind of a green phosphorescent scope that a sweep would go around. And when the sweep would highlight storms, they would glow briefly. And then you'd have to use a grease pencil to trace around the storm on the glass to know where the storm was, and then you'd have to do some things so that then you could outline just the most intense part of the storm. Well, it would take 5 or 10 minutes to trace all of the little glowing spots on the screen to see where the storms were at. Then you had to put this really, really thin paper over it that actually had a map on it and trace around your grease pencil lines onto the paper with a colored pencil so you actually could see where the storms were at. And then you turn around and type in some code into the computer that would send out the radar observations. So for me to go from that in a darkened room drawing on a piece of glass with a grease pencil for our radar observations to now basically everybody has radar in their pocket with a smartphone, to me is really mind-boggling because that's 20 years, but the leaps we've made in just those 20 years, not only in quality of the data available, but the availability of the data. Weather information is everywhere now. You know, you can get forecasts for anywhere in the world at any time of the day that you want it. It's just at our fingertips, either on our phone or the computer or on TV. And that's really, really kind of the thing that I've seen change the most over the last 20 years is the quality and availability of the data has just exploded. And it's probably not done yet.
And with that, there's a lot of different organizations out there that are supplying us some of this information. How does the National Weather Service work with other organizations to ensure that the most accurate weather forecasts and things are out there?
Well, most of the weather information originates at the National Weather Service, whether it's the observations or basically computer forecasts called numerical weather prediction models. A lot of the weather data, it's all supplied to all of the private weather companies like, you know, AccuWeather, the Weather Channel, all of the TV outlets. They can choose to make their own forecasts or they can use our forecasts. Many of them now just use our forecasts and then repackage them and sell them to not only media outlets like radio stations and TV stations, but also construction contractors. If they're going to be pouring cement on a one-mile stretch of road over the course of a week, obviously it's critical to them to have a good, accurate forecast of when it's going to rain, how much rain they're going to receive, so that they don't pour a bunch of concrete and then have it ruined by a downpour. We're seeing businesses all around, not only the country, but really the world, use weather data more and more to help optimize their businesses to eke out every little bit of profit they possibly can, because there's so many industries out there that are weather sensitive, whether it's construction or agriculture or even the shipping industry. Walmart actually has their own emergency operations center that employs meteorologists so that they can not only warn their stores of impending storms, you know, from warnings from the National Weather Service, but also they will ship certain items to certain stores. For instance, if they know a big nor'easter is going to go up the East Coast and it's going to be a blizzard up there, they're going to probably reroute trucks of snow shovels, you know, salt, anything you could possibly want for a winter storm. They'll use the forecast information to make sure that they have that stuff in stock at the locations that are going to be hit, not only to help maximize their profits, but also so that the folks there can count on being able to go to the store and get a snow shovel or get some other necessity they're going to need in advance of the storm.
I know one area, too, that the Weather Service has really been active in with technology the last few years is the webinars that you get with the various radio and television stations ahead of what you feel will be some major weather events, and really helps us get the word out as well and get the accurate word out when everybody can be on the same page with you.
That you just hit the nail on the head. The biggest reason we do that is so that everybody can be informed of exactly what we're talking about. And when we work with the emergency managers and the media outlets like the folks here at the radio station, just letting everybody know exactly what we're expecting so that we can all get on the same page with the impacts. And when the public hears a unified message that every outlet they turn to is basically saying, you're going to get 7 to 10 inches of snow, or you're going to get freezing rain, or we're looking at a big tornado outbreak tomorrow. When they hear that from many different sources, they trust it more. When the public hears one outlet say we're going to get 7 inches of snow tomorrow, another one says we're going to get an inch of freezing rain, and another says, no, we're going to get maybe some sleet or just regular rain, they really don't know what to do with that, and neither would I. You know, when you're getting this disparate information. So the more everybody can be on the same page, the more really the public benefits. And that's the whole purpose of those webinars and conference calls that our office initiates in advance of those storms.
Well, as we head into spring here, and hopefully we can get this winter behind us here a little bit, getting into the severe weather season, let's kind of shift things just a little bit and talk about what people need to be aware of as they get into spring each year.
Well, yeah, you know, we can very rapidly move from winter to spring thunderstorms, as, you know, we've seen in years past. And the things people need to take into really be thinking about is, first of all, we call it situational awareness. They really need to know what to expect later in the day when it comes to the weather. They need to be in tune with the forecast. And you can get your forecast, you know, there's almost an infinite number of places to get your forecast anymore. So just make sure you understand the forecast. You know that if there's thunderstorms forecast today, are they going to be strong? Are they going to be severe? Is that something you're going to have to really take action on, like seek shelter in case of a tornado or something like that? That's the biggest thing, is just build your situational awareness every single day. Know what the forecast is and be prepared to act. But the other thing is knowing how you're going to act. So when the warning's issued, you don't want to be deciding what to do when the warning's issued. You want to have that figured out well in advance. And for families out there, I tell them that can be as simple as sitting around the dinner table at night over your meal and talking about, okay, when the tornado warning is issued, here's what we're going to do. You know, kids in the dorms here at Northwest Missouri State, they can easily be talking to the RA or other administrative professionals. Okay, if a storm warning is issued, where should we go? Where do we seek shelter? And I'm sure, in fact, just walking through the buildings today, I've seen shelter designations at many of the buildings. So that a lot of that legwork's already been done in advance. But those are probably the two biggest things. Know what you're going to do when the warnings are issued, and then make sure that you understand the forecast and you can receive those warnings when they are issued so you know when to act.
And as far as a lot of people are driving now too, and through a long time as far as that goes too, but if you're caught out driving in a severe weather situation, what are some of the things that you need to do when you're out on the roadways in this region?
We can jump right to the big one, the tornadoes. And what we used to tell people when a tornado is bearing down on your vehicle, we used to tell people to get out of your car and go lay in a ditch or crawl in a culvert. That was one of the dumbest things we could have told people. What we tell people now is, if you're in your vehicle and a tornado is nearing you or you're driving towards a tornado, if you can drive away from the tornado, do it. It's that simple. Most tornadoes move from one location to another between 25 and 45 miles an hour. There's very few places in Northwest Missouri that you can't drive faster than 45 miles an hour and get away from that tornado. Now, perhaps you're up in Omaha or you're down in Kansas City and there's a traffic jam and you can't, you know, just drive away because it's just gridlock. In those situations, your best bet is to abandon your vehicle and get into a sturdy building, whether it's a business or a house, whether you know the people that live there or not. You've got to get out of the elements and get into that sturdy building to seek shelter. I tell people that you absolutely do not want to try to ride the tornado out in your car, or you do not want to have to use that last resort of getting into a ditch or a culvert, because really, if it's any kind of tornado at all, you're probably going to die in either one of those situations. So I can't stress enough, it's best not to be there in the first place.
Seems like in the last few years, you're seeing a lot of major storms come through the area, like Oklahoma a year or so ago, and some various other places. And is it a case of we're just hear more about these now with the way the information is relayed to people, or are we seeing more of an outbreak of a severe weather?
You know, we've looked at the statistics, and we're really not seeing more severe weather. It probably is just a factor of when news breaks, it's everywhere instantly. And disasters from anywhere in the world are really brought right into your phone again, or over the radio, or over TV. And it's that wasn't always the case, where we'd see that and we wouldn't see the media, you know, satellite trucks camped out at disasters for weeks on end after a big disaster. So I think it's more probably an awareness thing just that the modern media brings to the country when disasters strike.
Let's talk a little bit, too, about the various warnings and watches and things that you issue when a storm is approaching, and some of the key words that people need to keep in mind when they listen or see the text of a warning come on their phone or listen on the radio. What are some of the key words that the people need to keep in mind here?
Why don't we talk about the difference between a watch and a warning? When a severe thunderstorm or a tornado watch is issued, those can be issued anywhere from 1 to as many as 7 or 8 hours in advance of thunderstorms moving through. So when we issue a severe thunderstorm or a tornado watch, what we are telling people is you don't need to seek shelter. You just need to have a heightened sense of awareness, because if storms develop in or near that watch area, they could become severe or possibly tornadic. So really just kind of perk your ears up, pay a little closer attention to the weather. When a warning is issued and you're in that warning, that's when it's time to seek shelter. If it's a severe thunderstorm warning, it can be as simple as going inside and staying away from windows. If it's a tornado warning, that's when we need to, you know, do our full-on tornado sheltering, get down to the lowest level, into a basement if possible. If there's not a basement, get to an interior windowless room. Essentially, you want to put as many walls between you and the tornado as possible. But really, those are the two main things. If people can remember the difference between a watch and a warning, and then understand what to do when a severe thunderstorm warning is issued versus a tornado warning, that's all they really need to know.
And let's talk as well about the outlook for this spring. Is it too early to really tell what kind of a spring we're going to have with this, or do you kind of have a general idea right now?
You know, it's I don't want to say it is impossible, but it is pretty much impossible to forecast just how serious our severe thunderstorm season will be late in the spring, early into the summer. In the wintertime, sometimes we have some things we can hang our hat on, like El Nino or La Nina. That will give us some clues in the wintertime. But the signals aren't nearly as strong from El Nino or La Nina in the summertime. And so there's not a whole lot we can do to say it's either going to be a bad or not so bad severe weather season. And the reality is, any severe weather season, we're only one tornado away from having the perception of it being just a horrific season. For instance, here in Maryville, if we had a big tornado that went right through the middle of town, and that was the only tornado we had all year, for the folks here, that would be the worst, you know, severe weather season ever, versus the last couple of years where we've really kind of had we've been in the drought, obviously, which goes along with the lack of severe weather. So, you know, it's really hard to pin down, at least in people's perception, whether or not it's going to be a bad year, because again, we could have tornadoes everywhere, but if it doesn't impact, you know, a certain part of the state or the country, the perception is it wasn't that bad.
And the big question right now people are asking is, when's this winter going to be over with? It might talk a little bit about that, and how does this winter compare to past years?
Well, the guarantee is June. I will give you the guarantee the winter will be over by June. You know, last year we had snow in early May. And that was kind of a soul-crushing experience for those of us who were tired of winter. And I think we're all in the same boat there. You know, as we get into the late parts of March and early April, we're looking really some signs that we're going to get into the spring mode a lot more, and we're going to see the warm-ups have become more sustained. That's really about, you know, it's about as definite as I can give it. And it's kind of, you know, people say, well, yeah, sure, and it's going to be dark tonight and light tomorrow. But the good thing is, even if we get the occasional cold snap or we get a little bit of snow, it's not going to last, because we've got higher sun angles, we've got longer daylight hours. It's going to be much easier to spring back and warm up. But trust me, at the Weather Service, we're just like everybody else. We are so tired of winter.
One thing we might finish up where we started out a little bit. You talked about your background and how you got started in meteorology. You might, as for a student on the Northwest Missouri State campus, you might give some advice on someone who might be interested in getting into this field, and how the outlooks are for jobs in this particular field after graduation.
What I would tell somebody that's interested in meteorology, you know, the short answer is don't do it. And it's not because it's not a great career, a rewarding career, a good job. There's not going to be a lot of jobs in the future. You know, as we see computers get faster and faster, the number of meteorologists that are needed really decrease. You know, we're still hiring in the National Weather Service a few, but universities are really cranking out more meteorology students than we have jobs. And we've got an entry-level position in our office open right now, and we expect to have about 150 applicants for the one position. So the job market is tight. Not to say there aren't jobs, but, boy, I tell you what, you've got to be just literally the cream of the crop and a real superstar to get your foot in the door anymore. And so you know, if you have an interest in meteorology, there's some other fields you should look at. You should look at emergency management. That's a really big field, not only for local governments, but also for private business, preparing the, whether it's your community or your company, to deal with, everything from terrorism events to natural disasters, making sure all the plans are in place so folks know how to respond. Environmental science is huge. Anything to do with water quality or air quality is always going to be a strong field going forward. So, it's kind of meteorology-like. In fact, a lot of people that go into those fields major in atmospheric chemistry. That sort of career would really open up the door to a lot of those type professions. And if you're really dead set on it, I would just have a backup plan. If you think you're going to be in meteorology, that's fine, but you better have a plan B to go along with it just in case the jobs aren't there.
All right, well, Andy, thanks a lot for being with us.
My pleasure.
When we return to All Things Northwest, we'll visit with Northwest Missouri State University's Professor of Geography, Dr. Mark W. Corson, who will talk about his labor of love serving as the coordinator of the Interdisciplinary Program in Emergency and Disaster Management. You're listening to All Things Northwest on KXEV KRNW.
One of Northwest Missouri State's main goals is to promote a friendly atmosphere. Marketing major Lily Tai says friendliness is one reason she chose to attend Northwest.
First off, the mentality of the students here blows me away. I love how everyone is very friendly, outgoing, and takes you in like you're truly their family. Another reason is because it's a school for the students. It tries in every aspect to help the students, better the students, push them to be the best that they can. Even the teachers, they know your name.
Ty is a freshman from St. Joseph.
Support for All Things Northwest comes from the Northwest Missouri Regional Council of Governments. They'll be holding a waste tire collection Saturday for residents of Atchison, Gentry, Holt, Nottoway, and Worth counties. The collection will be held from 8 in the morning until noon at the Holt County Maintenance Barn in Oregon. Details are available at our website at kxcv.org.
Northwest Missouri State offers opportunities to get involved. Albany native Ted Place says involvement is why he chose Northwest.
Not when I was a junior or senior, but from day one. And I have a degree in journalism, and I wanted to be involved and be able to write and be a part of all that was going on. The quality was high, and the opportunities to be involved early were very good.
Place graduated from Northwest in 1999. He currently serves as the Executive Director for Community Development at Kansas City Public Television and 90.9 The Bridge Public Radio.
Underwriting support for All Things Northwest is provided by Nottoway County Economic Development, promoting the community, supporting business development, and growing opportunity for Northwest Missouri. The NCED Business Support Team is at your service. More at nottoway.biz.
Welcome back to the April 2014 edition of All Things Northwest. I'm your host, John Jasinski. We'll now visit with Dr. Mark Corson, professor of geography who has been with Northwest for over 15 years. He serves as the department chair, that's the Department of Natural Sciences. His labor of love, his current one anyways, is his additional role as the coordinator of the Interdisciplinary Program in Emergency and Disaster Management. We call it EDM here on campus. He teaches the Principles of Humanitarian Relief course as well as Homeland Security and Defense. Dr. Corson has a master's and a PhD in geography as well as a master's of strategic studies from the Army War College. He is a retired U.S. Army Brigadier General with over 30 years of military service as a tank officer, geography professor at West Point, and as a combat logistician. He served in Kosovo in 2001 and two tours in Iraq, 2003 through 2004 and 2010 through 2011. He was the senior sustainment commander for the U.S. Forces Iraq during his second deployment. He's married to Michelle Corson, who teaches French at Maryville High School, and he has two daughters. Mark, welcome to All Things Northwest.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we really enjoy not just your teaching and your academic leadership, but certainly your service to the United States of America. And we thank you for that. You've got a long and distinguished career, both for the U.S. and certainly at Northwest. So talk a little bit about your experiences first about your service to the country.
Well, thank you for your thanks, but it's really been my privilege to serve. I had 11 years active duty and about 19 years reserve. I actually just retired this month after 30 years of military service as a brigadier general in the U.S. Army Reserve. I started out in 1983. You ask the students, what were you doing in 1983? And it gives them a sense of just how long that is. I was an armor officer during the good old days of the Cold War, defending freedom's frontiers, and then subsequently had opportunity to teach at West Point, and that's how I got into the geography business, teaching at West Point. After the drawdown of 94, when I got out of the active army, I went right to the Army Reserve, went right to graduate school to get my PhD, and been going ever since, and had a couple of opportunities to serve overseas.
And the listeners, you heard, you know, my intro to Dr. Corson here about his service overseas and sustainment officer, and you know, there's a lot of other subplots, if you will, and subtext about what Mark has done for our country. But Mark, congratulations and thank you. I know the retirement is somehow good in some ways and bittersweet in others.
A little bit. You know, everything has its time, and I wouldn't trade it for anything. I had the opportunity to command as a general officer in combat, which is statistically very unlikely, and was a great privilege to command great American service members and our contractors, for that matter. My wife is teasing me, though. As we'll find out, my labor of love is the Emergency and Disaster Management Program. And she says, so basically, you were gone 3 weekends a month and all summer and making some pretty good money at that. And now that you've retired, you've replaced that with all of this disaster management stuff, and you're gone every weekend, and we pay for it. And I said, well, that's retirement for you. It's the way it goes.
That's right. That's exactly. Well, we thank you for that, too. Let's talk about your service to Northwest Missouri State. 15 years in the classroom, lots of committees and so on. But talk about your labor of love in the classroom and geography. Then we'll kind of move into emergency disaster management.
Well, interestingly, I never had an undergraduate geography course, and I came to it late when applying for teaching positions at West Point, the United States Military Academy, as a not-so-young captain, actually. And it was actually geography that hired me. And so University of South Carolina for my master's degree with Julian Mingy in political geography. Most of my academic work at that time focused on I was an Army transportation officer by then, so my very first geography course was geography of ports and shipping, and I was in a transportation terminal unit doing ports and shipping. And so it worked out that much of my military activity was very closely related to what I did as an academic as well, subsequently going into military geography as well as political geography with an environmental bent, which is a big thing in the military. And it's been a great run, and I still do love geography, but I find now that I've transitioned to take a lot of that geographic knowledge into the emergency and disaster management area.
Well, it's a good transition to talk about EDM, as I talked to our listeners earlier, emergency disaster management. We say interdisciplinary here, and we've talked about that actually on this program, All Things Northwest, previously, but it is an interdisciplinary program where students from many different academic disciplines and faculty and staff from disciplines come together and work towards a common cause. But kind of give the listeners a broad overview of what this emergency disaster management program is all about.
Well, we took a look at the world and we said, you know, clearly, I mean, the world's always had its disasters and catastrophes and crises, but we took a look at both what was happening in the world as well as we might say the marketplace or the employment potential for students and the community needs for the longer term. And one of the things we saw was that emergency management, which is related but different than the fire service or law enforcement, criminal justice, or the emergency medical component, it really is management, that it was professionalizing in the sense that many people that were coming into the field actually were degreed in that there were, in the New York Times reported that there are actually 300 programs in either emergency management, homeland security, or some variation thereon in the country, but that we were not that well represented here, particularly in Northwest Missouri. Our colleagues at the University of Central Missouri have an emergency management program, but it's online. And so we felt there was an opportunity here for our students, but it was pretty clear we weren't going to hire a lot of outside people, a lot of new people, you might say, and I mean, we have to be good stewards of the public's money, But we looked at our own internal resources and we said, wow, what a talent pool we have. Let's put something together that's turned out so far to be, and I think it's really got legs to be a great program.
So if I'm a student, Mark, I'm exploring programs, and I say, boy, that emergency disaster management seems appropriate to my competencies, my love, my skill set. What might I learn in the program itself?
Well, the comprehensive emergency management cycle of mitigation, preparedness, then there's the disaster, then there's response recovery. After September the 11th, FEMA added in, the Federal Emergency Management Agency added in prevention. So if you take that as a start, you're going to start off with an introduction to emergency response and recovery. That then is going to follow, which some people think is odd, but I'll explain that it makes perfect sense, with principles of humanitarian relief, because really, whether it's overseas or domestic, oftentimes it's about providing relief to people in need, preventing and alleviating human suffering. Subsequently, you'll do homeland security and defense. And then along with that, this is where the interdisciplinary piece comes in. Those three courses were designed specifically for the EDM program. But then you're going to take disaster psychology, because that's hugely important. And we've got an awesome instructor in Dr. April Haberion to teach that. You'll take crisis communication with Joy Daggs. You'll take federalism and intergovernmental relations, because frankly, it's all about the money and how to make levels of government work with various parts of the community. You'll take geography of natural disasters, which is slightly misnamed now. It's really an all-hazards approach. And then there's a series of other components you can take. Interestingly enough, we now have people participating or soon to participate with our partners at UCM in their online components for business continuity. We have business majors who are focusing on that, as well as some folks who actually ag majors who are doing hazardous materials mitigation, remediation type work through UCM, and that's going to be exciting. And here's what I think is really special about the program. Many programs have an internship requirement, as do we. There's a couple of ways to fulfill that. First off, your traditional internship. We've had folks go work with Homeland Security Investigations. We just met with the State Emergency Management Agency. We're very excited about internships for them coming up. We've had folks that have gone to, of course, Nottoway County, Buchanan County Emergency Management. We have a student who's going to be with the Kansas City Police Department this summer as an intern. So the internship piece is very interesting. But the other opportunity is if a student is interested in going towards a technical skill, we have an opportunity for them to become a licensed emergency medical technician through a working partnership with Northwest Technical School.
Well, and you just mentioned, you know, a lot of different faculty from different academic disciplines, obviously, but varying organizations, universities, the technical school, a variety of internship providers, if you will. And so as I think about partnerships being the wave of the future for higher education, this program really is part and parcel to all of that, because you guys, the tentacles that you have in terms of reaching out to a variety of sectors and organizations is pretty huge. You also talk, Mark, about internships. The other part behind emergency disaster management is this hands-on experience, these field experiences. Talk about those, because one thing to go out and do an internship, and you know, for those of us that have those internships, those have been life-changing experiences. Those are excellent experiences. But then to be able to uplift those with some field experience is very interesting, and I've had a chance to actually see some of this. So talk about that with our listeners.
Well, many programs have experiential learning opportunities. We think ours are kind of special, and to be perfectly honest, our EDM students, I'm sure every program says this, but they really are special, because with the type of student we have is the type of person that we'll take out, I'll talk about this in a minute, but to Atlantic Hope or Missouri Hope, our field training exercise, and we will put them, the technical language is, into a high fidelity, high intensity simulation. But what that means is that this is really intellectually challenging, it's really emotionally challenging, and we really push them. And they'll be tired and they'll be dirty. They might be a little covered with a little bit of smoke and perhaps some fake blood, hopefully not anything real. And at the end of it all, they'll say, wow, I really learned a lot. What are we doing next? And that's what we love about our EDM students. They're always just, what are we doing next? And so we are part of a consortium for humanitarian service and education. And we work with schools from all over the country to do these particular experiential exercises. And then we also integrate things, for example, the emergency medical responder course, which I just completed here from the ambulance district, into these experiential learning requirements. But that's what, between Missouri Hope and Atlantic Hope, I think gives it a flavor that's really special.
Let's talk about that, because Northwest participated in Atlantic Hope for a couple of years. We've sent students down there, faculty, et cetera. Maybe talk about that briefly, but then our team said, you know what, we can replicate Atlantic Hope here in Missouri. And then we launched Missouri Hope 13. We're planning for Missouri Hope 14. So talk briefly about Atlantic Hope and how that launched Missouri Hope.
Atlantic Hope is an overseas disaster-based humanitarian aid disaster relief simulation. It's at Indian River State College, their Treasure Coast Public Safety Complex, which is really kind of a $47 million training facility that's very impressive. We have students from all over the country that have come to that. This last year, I think I've been doing it for 6 or 7 years now, other than I missed a couple of years for the deployment to Iraq. But we've had students going to that, and our faculty as well, and it is a great exercise. It is a life-changing event for many people. One of the big things about the EDM program is, like it or not, leadership and followership is a huge component of the program for students, and they're going to be thrust into leadership positions, which for many is outside their comfort zone. And it's what an amazing transformation happens when people who have never led before suddenly find that they can successfully lead under very difficult conditions. That is life-changing for them. So Atlantic Hope is a great program, but it's also expensive to go down there. And we felt that we needed to create an opportunity, as we have now so many students that require this, that we had to do it here at Northwest.
And so Missouri Hope 13 begins, well, the planning went for quite a while, but then it took place here late last fall. Maybe talk about that experience and how it's launched Missouri Hope 14, because everything I see and read about Missouri Hope 14, it's going to take Missouri Hope 13 and put it on steroids in a way.
That's very true. We decided that we needed to demonstrate to the world that we were serious, and also demonstrate to ourselves that we could do it. Missouri Hope 13, it was in October of 13, and we actually started planning it in October of 12. And we called it a 3x3x3. So some of the partners we have were the City of Maryville. We used the Mazingo Youth Camp as our staging base, which is a gorgeous facility. People should put it to use. And then, of course, we're very fortunate in that we have the Missouri Outdoor Education and Recreation Center, MOERA, which is our 300 acres, and that includes not only classroom facilities right on the lake there, but also our colleagues in Health and Human Services have their $150,000 ropes challenge course, which is an amazing training facility. And then, taking into account we didn't want to mar the landscape, we've been building out a disaster simulation facility with various partners so that we essentially have a disaster village to work with. So we had three teams of 11 students. They rotated leadership positions. They each did the disaster simulation lane. They did a high-angle rescue with the ropes challenge course. And then subsequently, they ran the incident command post to coordinate the whole thing, and they rotated those opportunities. And then we had our partners from the Red Cross from St. Joseph come in, and they did introduction to disaster services one night and shelter operations the other night. And then our third component was a very robust and challenging simulated press conference, so that the students could put their public information officer skills and interaction with the press skills to work.
Hey, listeners, you're listening to All Things Northwest on KXCB KRNW. I'm your host, John Jasinski, talking right now with Northwest Missouri State University's Dr. Mark Corson. We're talking about the Emergency Disaster Management Program. Mark, you're describing the Missouri Hope 2013 experience. As an observer, I was able to be out there at Mazingo for a small portion of the proceedings. You say it's life-changing for the students. I'll tell you, just for my limited time there, you can even see where it's life-changing, where you really get a different mindset and a different feeling about disaster preparedness and response, even as an observer. So since then, you know, we've talked about planning for 2014. Talk about the plans up and coming for this fall's activities.
Well, you came out and actually were, I don't know if you realized that you were a training aide for a distinguished visitor iteration. You'll recall this student.
I do recall that, actually.
The student who briefed you, who actually prepped, Abby Lawrence did a great job.
Yes, she did.
We had other visitors, to include colleagues from St. Luke's College of Allied Health. And they were so excited, they actually sent an instructor and 9 students to Atlantic Hope, and they're looking to bring a hospital in a box to Missouri Hope, where we'll actually have some place to take the casualties and for the opportunity for their nursing students and other nursing students from programs around the area to provide this acute nursing care in this disaster simulation. Our partners at the 129th Field Artillery Battalion here in Maryville, they're looking to bring some of their combat medics and their ambulance. Our partners with some of the rescue squads through the Nottoway County Ambulance District are looking to participate with us. And of course, we've the Maryville Fire Department, as well as Maryville Public Safety. Our own University Police Department plays an integral role with this. The Buchanan County Emergency Manager, Bill Britton, will be helping us. He's got 30 years of experience. So what's happened is we have so many partners who have seen this as a great training opportunity to both contribute to the education of our students, but to be perfectly honest, nobody works for free. And what folks are looking at is saying this is a great opportunity to train and integrate these community agencies, and it's creating great relationships. That's just very productive and useful for our community.
Listeners, this experience really is. It's life-changing, but it's driving partnerships across communities, better response, better communication. And so we're very proud of that here at Northwest. Thank you for your leadership. Mark, we've got the Missouri Hope 14 activities up and coming, but also we've got a program called CERT. And we use a lot of acronyms around here at Northwest. But talk about the CERT program and what it's all about and what you're doing currently.
Well, our saying for CERT is be a responder and not a victim. And CERT stands for Community Emergency Response Team. This is a 24-hour Federal Emergency Management Agency certificate course that we're able to offer here at Northwest. And essentially what it covers is disaster preparedness, fire safety and small fire suppression, light search and rescue, disaster medical operations, which is actually a little bit of first aid, but as well as triage operations and how to run a treatment area, as well as actually terrorism and CERT, and as importantly, CERT organization through the incident command system. And in fact, we'll have run three iterations of it for not only faculty, students, and staff, but also community members. And our partners at NUCOR LMP in Maryville have been extremely enthused about this and have provided many of their staffers. And interestingly, the staffers have been ringing their family members.
Wow. Well, CERT certainly has that history of providing great service, and it's just indicative of the programming that we offer here at Northwest Missouri State University, that it's community-minded. We reach out to organizations. We provide that to organizations, and it sounds like now to their loved ones, too. But also, it links back to students and providing for student success. So talk about emergency disaster management students and what kind of careers they might explore as they go through these variety of experiences.
The program started as a minor in 2009, and subsequently, due to student demand, we were able to make it a major in 2012. And what we find now is that our first crop of students that graduated recently, they've done very well. One of them was hired by Douglas County Emergency Management. Another actually runs for the American Red Cross, the Disaster Services Program for the 11 counties in eastern Kansas. And we've had folks that have also gone off to various state emergency management agencies. And we're, interestingly enough, finding that there are those students who are interested in going into law enforcement or emergency medicine or things of that nature, but also the insurance industry, which has catastrophic claims adjusters. They've expressed interest in our students because they can teach people to be a claims adjuster, but the other skill sets that are required in a disaster, they believe we educate our students very well in those skills, and that's very desirable for them.
I love hearing about that because, you know, higher education stands for so much out there. A certain segment of the population want it to be only jobs-based. That's not what higher ed is only about. It's partly what we're about, but certainly providing for a more educated citizenry, more informed democracy, and so on. But as you talk about it, it isn't just one sector or another that's looking at our students. It's many. And so, again, we're providing for that student success. That's our mission here at Northwest Missouri State University, focusing on student success every student every day. Mark, to close this portion of the program, talk about the future of emergency disaster management.
Well, as what we see is this continued professionalization of the field. And in discussing with our colleagues in Homeland Security, we're looking at different opportunities to expand the program, to continue our emphasis on emergency management in terms of disaster response and recovery preparedness, preparation, but as well to look at extending the program along with criminal justice, of which we have a minor, more towards the law enforcement, criminal justice, homeland security component. Our colleagues, particularly in Homeland Security, tell us that from a workforce development aspect, that they need highly qualified people in that area, that they're going to continue to have many, many jobs, and they think we can make a contribution to that.
Well, that's tremendous. We so much appreciate the program, your leadership, all of your colleagues, and certainly all of our partners. Listeners, that's Dr. Mark Corson, retired Brigadier General, Department Chair here at Northwest Missouri State University, and currently in his labor of love, that's emergency disaster management. And that's a wrap for this month's show. All Things Northwest is a program devoted to all the good about the people, places, events, and stories of our region. We thank our guests, Andy Bailey from the National Weather Service in Pleasant Hill, and Northwest Missouri State University's Dr. Mark Corson. Thanks, too, to our producer, Ben Nully, a student here at Northwest Missouri State University, along with KXCV-KRNW station manager, Rodney Harris. Friends, take good care. Treat each other well, provide good works for others, and keep celebrating and advancing our region. I'm John Chasinski, and thanks for your support of All Things Northwest, KXCV-KRNW, and Public Radio.
Support for All Things Northwest comes from Nottoway County Economic Development and Northwest Missouri Regional Council of Governments. More on Facebook at facebook.com/NWMORCOG. Theme music for the program was composed by Northwest professor Dr. William Richardson. The music was recorded by vocal music education major Jordan Andrews, piano, music major Daniel Bates, bass, audio and production major Mark Ludwig, drums, and Dr. William Richardson, trumpet. The program is written and produced by multimedia journalism major Ben Nolley. Join us again next month for All Things Northwest.